Before we start, a quick reminder. This podcast discusses sex, violence, and social oppression. It may be uncomfortable or triggering to some. If you're listening out loud, parts of this narrative may seem sensitive to those around you. How much do you remember about December 2013?
I've been a rich man.
The Hollywood film Wolf of Wall Street came out.
I want to do something different.
Nirvana made it into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Most revered statesmen.
Nelson Mandela passed away. And on the 15th, 4 days after the Indian Supreme Court had recriminalized gay sex, queer activists across 18 cities gathered for the Global Day of Rage. I was part of a small group of protesters holding a placard that read, "You can't criminalize love." Next to me, a friend had a more creative sign. "Two moms make a right. No going back."
Somebody has a sign here saying you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube, which is the reality. You cannot do that. There is no going back.
I still remember this. I've said it many, many times, but I still want to say this again.
I spoke with Arvind Narayan, who is a founding lawyer at the Alternative Law Forum, a human rights advocacy organization based in Bangalore. In court, ALF had represented Voices Against 377, a group of activists who set out to show the judges how much queer people had suffered because of their criminalized status. Understandably, the 2013 verdict was a big blow to Arvind. He had just lost this very important case, and one that, as a gay man, was very personal to him. This is how he remembers his day of rage.
A friend of ours, Akhil Katyal, who's a poet, he addressed the rally in Delhi, and he spoke in Hindi. And I can't say this in Hindi, but he narrated this poem by Langston Hughes, which is titled "A Dream Deferred," and it goes this way. It says, "What happens to dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Does it run like stinking meat? Or does it explode?" He said, "This dream is poised to explode. You can't keep us back." And that was the slogan, which is "no going back." That was the slogan which was there.
There is no going back.
The hearing for the case had gone badly from the start. The judges had asked a lot of questions about what the words of the law meant, and they even asked the lawyers if they knew any gay people at all. But as badly as things had gone, few people expected the outcome of 2013. Pavan Dal is a Kolkata-based queer rights activist and an author. He was in the courtroom when the verdict was delivered, and he was really surprised.
Although I didn't realize what the verdict was until we came out, which is when I saw long faces. It was like a slap in the face when it turned out that actually we had gone back to 2009 or pre-2009.
Before the judgment had been announced, Anand Grover, the lawyer representing the NAS Foundation, led a community meeting about the possible outcomes of the case. By this time, the hearings had been completed and people were waiting for the verdict. Pavan was at that meeting.
There were five possibilities that we had thought of. One of them was, yes, that the court would completely dismiss the petition and bring back 377. But nobody in their wildest dreams ever thought that that option would really be the one that would come through.
The Supreme Court of India had dealt a devastating blow to the LGBTQI community. But talking to the people who had been involved with the case, I realized something. The judges may have overturned the Delhi High Court's 2009 ruling, but they couldn't erase the fact that it had happened. In 2009, queer people were classified as a class of their own and were guaranteed their fundamental rights through a progressive interpretation of the Constitution. So even though 377 was back, they hadn't forgotten what victory felt like. There was no going back. From ATS Studio, I'm Sindhuri Nandakumar, and this is 377, a podcast about an archaic law, its fading impact, and the movement to get rid of it. In our previous episode, we discussed the Supreme Court case of Suresh Kumar Kaushal and others versus NAS Foundation. It resulted in the recriminalization of homosexuality. The two judges ruled that homosexuals were a minuscule minority and therefore didn't warrant protection through the Constitution.
The sense of restaging a lot of the hurt and the shame that had happened outside the courtroom space, but now it was happening inside the courtroom. It was these two senior members of the judiciary who were just saying these things casually.
You know, it was like the school kids kind of squirming on their seats while sexuality and queerness was being discussed.
Today, we're going to talk about what happens next, about how another landmark ruling in the Supreme Court gave queer activists fresh hope. A ruling that addressed one of India's most persecuted sexual minorities, trans people. But first, let's take a look at the aftermath of the Kaushal verdict. You know, there are cases in the legal system where you don't like the outcome because it's not what you wanted, but you get it. You say, okay, I understand how the judges interpreted that. But with the Kaushal case, not many people felt that way. If you remember, we spoke with Tarunab Khaitan in the previous episode, the constitutional law expert. He talked about how the court had wrongly applied a legal principle called de minimis.
In the Kaushal judgment, the two judges of the Supreme Court applied the de minimis principle to say that the number of people affected by the law in question is so small. And by the way, this small is relative, right? Even a small percentage, 5% of India's population in absolute numbers is massive.
Then there are the idiosyncrasies of the Supreme Court that also play a role in how matters are decided. India's Supreme Court, which is one of the biggest apex courts in the world, is swamped with cases.
Almost no other top court in the world in major democracies sees this volume of matter, around 70,000 cases passing through its docket every year.
Broadly speaking, there are two types of cases that the court handles: constitutional cases and appeals cases. Appeals are cases where you escalate a matter from a lower court if you believe the judgment was wrong. So Kaushal, for instance, came to the Supreme Court because he appealed the Delhi High Court judgment. Constitutional cases, on the other hand, are a loftier exercise. They involve an interpretation of the law, where the judges try and see whether a law is compatible with the Constitution, making sure that it doesn't violate any of the guarantees that citizens are offered. This is based on an understanding that society changes and laws should change with us. We have to find a way in our legal system to ensure that, for example, practices like slavery or untouchability, which were once condoned by the law, are no longer permitted.
So the cases it believes are important needs to be dealt with in a deliberative, thoughtful manner. It sends it to a higher bench of 5 judges or more, which takes its time, which writes a deliberative judgment.
In many countries, these two responsibilities are divided. You have an appellate court and a constitutional court. But in India, they are one and the same. 2 functions, 1 court. Simple enough, right? Thing is, the line between the two functions is kind of blurry. So, even though Kaushal was an appeal, it was also a constitutional case. The whole basis of the matter was figuring out whether 377 violated any rights that are promised in the Constitution. And the Constitution of India dictates that all cases that involve a law or a significant interpretation of the Constitution should be heard by at least 5 judges in the Supreme Court. So even though Kaushal was an appeals case, the fact that it dealt with the Constitution meant that it should have been heard by at least 5 judges. But in this case, there were only 2. Why?
I have found that the appellate function of the Indian Supreme Court is so voluminous that it's cannibalizing. It's eating up its constitutional function. And basically, the court has very little time left to spend on constitutional defense. The vast majority of cases are dealt with in a rule of thumb, panchayati justice type model by 2 or 3 judges. And those are the cases where I think the quality of justice can be really doubtful.
Even the government of the day, the UPA coalition led by the Congress Party, was dismayed by the Kaushal ruling. By this time, the Congress Party was pretty clear that it supported the reading down of 377. The day after the verdict, then Finance Minister P. Chidambaram said this about how his party felt.
I think the bench should have referred it to a 5-judge bench, and they should have looked into all aspects of law. The law cannot be static. An interpretation of law cannot be static. What we have done is gone back in time to 1860, and I'm therefore terribly disappointed.
At this point, there were a couple of options in front of activist groups and organizations like the NAS Foundation. You can't escalate the matter to a higher court because there is none, but you can file a review petition, and if that fails, a curative petition. In fact, even the central government filed a review on the basis that there were errors in the judgment. A question that I had at this point, and many others even at the time, was since the government was sympathetic, couldn't parliamentary action have been an option, like the court had suggested? Well, keep in mind it was election season, months before the BJP would take power. And the Congress party even admitted that 377 just wasn't a priority. This is what Congress MP Abhishek Manu Singhvi had to say at the time.
Now, practically, however much you may want it, and our president, vice president, and the party has made it very clear where our stand lies, however much you may want it, I don't know whether it can be that priority item in the short 11-day session looming large in the next week or the week after that. It's an 11-12-day session. Obviously, the stated priority is 6 vital anti-corruption bills.
Then there was Shashi Tharoor.
It is in this spirit.
Lok Sabha MP and member of the Congress party, who often acted like a lone wolf. He decided to try one more route in the legislature. Twice, once in 2015 and once in 2016, he introduced a private member's bill. This is basically a bill introduced by any member of parliament who's not in the cabinet. Both times, he lost. By a pretty big margin.
Those in favor may say aye. Those against may say no. Now the division. Subject to correction, the result of the division is ayes 14, noes 58. So leave is not granted for introduction of the bill. Motion is negative.
Despite the occasional murmurs of support from both Congress and later BJP politicians, it really didn't feel like Parliament was going to do anything about 377. Just weeks after the Kaushal verdict, the Supreme Court dismissed the review petitions filed by NAS and its allies. There was just one option left, a curative petition, the last resort for a losing party. It's a relatively new mechanism created in 2002. Here's Anand Grover.
Then in a very important judgment called Rupa Ashok Hura, the Supreme Court said, look, if there can be mistakes even when there's a review. So they said that our jurisdiction should be such that it can actually, in the interest of justice, even correct final judgments after the review.
But it's not an easy process. If you want to file a curative, you have to show that there was a gross miscarriage of justice and that the valid arguments in your review petition hadn't been considered by the judges. These appeals are not easy, and the rates of success are not very promising.
99% of the review petitions are dismissed. And in curatives, they don't even reach the stage of open hearing. So,
has any major case reached open hearing with the curative besides?
Quite a few, okay. Not many.
The NAS Foundation and other groups filed curatives in 2014. They said that their arguments had not been heard on their merits in 2012, and they wanted another chance to present them to the court. While these curatives were pending, just a few months later, another interesting case developed.
India's transgender community has officially been recognized by the Supreme Court. Two Supreme Court judges advised the government to make sure that transgenders or those who identify with a different sex than their own are recognized legally as a third sex. The court also said recognizing them is not a social or medical issue, but a human rights issue.
This was National Legal Aid Services, NALSA, versus Union of India, a landmark verdict delivered in April 2014. And it was also a public interest litigation case. NALSA was set up by the government to provide free legal services to communities that needed it. Along with other petitioners who included NGOs and trans activists, NALSA asked the court for more rights for India's diverse transgender population. One big grievance was that trans people couldn't express their gender identity freely and were often perceived as belonging to the gender they were associated with at birth. Trans history in India is rich and diverse. The communities identify themselves using a range of terms. Hijras, Kotis, Kinnars, Aravani, Tirunangai, Jogappas. They're not so much descriptive terms as they are named communities. Hijras, for instance, belong to communities that go back centuries and are perceived as having the power to bless families at weddings, births, and other rituals. Lakshmi Narayan Tripathi is a transgender activist and one of the petitioners in the Nalsa case. This is an aside, but Lakshmi was represented in court by Anand Grover.
I belong to the oldest ethnic transgender community, which is known as the Hijras. We say we are neither man nor woman. We are the third gender.
The English word transgender, as the Nalsa judgment rightly points out, is a very all-encompassing, sort of broad term. It covers a spectrum. It includes people who cross-dress, people who identify with a different gender than the one they're born into, and even people who don't identify with any gender at all. It also includes those who have had sexual reassignment surgery, as well as those who haven't. Despite all of this diversity, one thing is clear. In modern Indian society, trans people have been marginalized. Just like with the wider queer community, colonialism played a part in that. 377 was used to prosecute trans people, but there was more colonial legislation that made their lives very difficult. The Criminal Tribes Act of 1871, for example, labeled entire communities as criminals and demanded that, quote, eunuchs register themselves with government authorities, claiming that they were prone to criminal activity like kidnapping children.
It's a social stigma of having a transgender or a hijra child at home. There are many parents who disown the children, so they had to leave or they were thrown out of the houses.
Trans people have been pushed to the fringes of society. Some families kick their trans children out. Government officials refuse to give them IDs and they were forced to take up sex work or begging just to survive. I'm using the past tense here, but really that discrimination hasn't gone away. If you have been following the passage of the Transgender Protection Bill of 2019, you probably know that it fails to incorporate some of the guarantees that the Nalsa verdict makes. And while trans people come under the LGBT umbrella, they haven't always felt included in queer activism. But the Nalsa judgment helped change that. It showed how integral the trans community was to the fight against 377. In the Supreme Court, Nalsa asked that trans people have the right to express their gender identity freely and for the right to be considered a third sex if they didn't identify as either male or female. The judges ruled in their favor and said that trans people are entitled to the same constitutional protections as other citizens. In a sensitively worded judgment, the two justices said that gender identity should be determined by how a person feels and not by the gender they were associated with at birth. If you remember our last episode, the Kaushal judgment said that sexual orientation couldn't fall within the ambit of Article 15 of the Constitution, which forbids discrimination on the basis of sex. The Nalsa judgment reversed that by saying exactly the opposite. This time, the judges said that gender identity, what gender you feel an affinity to, is an integral part of sex, and no citizen can be discriminated on the ground of gender identity, including those who identify as third gender. And because the gender you identify with is so integral to your sexual orientation, the judges said that discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation would be unconstitutional. So without saying it in those exact words, the Supreme Court had essentially pointed out a flaw in its own judgment from the previous year, the Kaushal judgment. But as far as direct references to 377 were concerned, the court stayed cautious. The judges said that they didn't want to comment on the constitutionality of Kaushal because they were dealing with a different issue here. Anand Grover explains why.
Yeah, they would not be able to say we disagree and we are overruling it because a coordinate bench of the same number cannot overrule that that judgment.
A Supreme Court bench can only overturn an earlier ruling if it has more judges than the previous one.
So what they did very cleverly was they stayed clear of saying anything about 377, though they refer to it and they say, we're not going to touch it.
They did, however, say, it is now very well recognized that the Constitution is a living character. Its interpretation must be dynamic. It must be understood in a way that advances modern reality. The judiciary is the guardian of the Constitution. The trans community welcomed the judgment. It was a spectacular victory for them and a step in the right direction. There's a really heartwarming video of Dr. Akkay Padmashali, a trans activist, showing her newly obtained driving license to a television news channel. She had never applied for one before because she was afraid she would be denied if she ticked female next to her gender. But NALSA allowed her to make that decision on her own terms. Getting a government-issued ID is something that most of us take for granted. But for trans people, it took a Supreme Court ruling to win that right. The NALSA verdict also gave the trans community the motivation to ask for more rights.
It was very equal and equal and equal. The officials, the general public.
I spoke with Jenna Kothari, a Supreme Court lawyer, who had been a part of the NALSA case.
But it was really 2014 with the NALSA judgment that galvanized the trans activists. Because, you know, it was for the first time that there was no recognition. You know, the LGBT, even within the LGBT movement, they were at the fringes. You know, the fight in India was for sexual orientation recognition. And so the trans community was at the fringes of the LGBT movement as well. But it was only when the NALSA judgment said that there is a right to gender identity and the right to self-identify your gender, that you have a right to be transgender. You have a right to be another gender, different from the sex that you're assigned at birth. You know, these rights, you know, gave that impetus and strength to trans activists to say, yes, we actually, you know, can push for our rights.
In 2015, even as trans people were celebrating the NALSA verdict, they were fully aware that Section 377 still remained. This is the activist Dr. Akkay Padmashali talking at the time.
My question is that we are living in 21st century. It's very saddening that it's violating of our, I think, complete fundamental constitutional and, of course, international declaration of human rights. I think some of the government of India should come to the forefront and do that. And, of course, Prime Minister is visiting to so many countries. He never spoke about a single word on Section 377. He never spoke a single word on sexual orientation or gender identity. I think that is very disappointing and saddening.
But the NALSA judgment seemed to light a fire under the 377 case. Just a week after the verdict, the Supreme Court accepted a plea for a curative petition. In February 2016, the curative was heard by three judges who recognized the constitutional aspect of the case and referred it to be heard by a five-judge constitutional bench. This is Dr. Akkay Padmashali celebrating the good news.
And today is an historical day. I think the day should definitely go in the history records. I think that way we are very, very much positively waiting across the world. Across the world, we are. That's why I'm quite pink today.
That's why I'm quite pink today, says a beaming Akkay who is wearing a beautiful pink sari. Now, this is where things get a bit complicated, at least for me. So these curative petitions are pending in the Supreme Court, awaiting a date for a hearing with five judges. But just a few months later, in June 2016, five individuals from the LGBTQ community, who had had nothing to do with the case so far, filed fresh petitions against Section 377. Let's call them the Famous Five. These are not public interest litigations of the kind that the NAS Foundation filed on behalf of an aggrieved group of people. These petitions were filed by people who argued that their own rights had been deprived by Section 377. This kind of direct access to the apex court is guaranteed by Article 32 of the Constitution, which Dr. Ambedkar called the heart and soul of India's Constitution. So let's clear things up here. There are a bunch of curative petitions in the Supreme Court dating back to the 2013 ruling. There were around eight of these. And then there's this new Famous Five petition, unconnected to the curatives. At this point, lawyer Jena Kothari had been working with Akkai Padmashali, the trans activist. At the state level, Akkai had been very involved in campaigning against laws that discriminated against trans people, like Section 36A of the Karnataka Police Act. Remember, once you're recognized as a third sex, Article 15 kicks in. The Constitution protects you from discrimination on the basis of sex.
That kind of victory, that the law can be used, to discriminatory laws can be challenged and such challenges can be won positively, I think gave a further push to Akkai and to other trans activists in Karnataka to say that, listen, we should actually get into the 377 fight in the Supreme Court. So we then were discussing that, you know, how does NALSA revive this fight? And, you know, NALSA kind of gave rights to the trans community. And we were discussing this and we said, you know, there is a window that trans activists can challenge 377. And Akkai and two other activists from Karnataka, Jeeva, Umi from Jeeva and Sana. So they were very, very keen to do that. And so we decided to file the petition, and we filed this petition, and actually they are the only trans petitioners in all the petitions, you know, so that was also very important.
So in July 2016, Akkai, Umi and Sana also filed a fresh Article 32 petition in the Supreme Court. They have since said that they were not aware of the famous five and their petition. They cite NALSA and argue that this same court has said that discrimination on the grounds of sexual orientation is not done. So please consider reading down 377. If, they said, trans people set out to express the rights granted to them by NALSA, they would be seen as criminals by 377. In the petition, the NALSA verdict is cited many times, and it's clear that it provided a big advantage to the anti-377 activists. So after 2016, things were gaining rapid momentum. In 2017, when former US President Barack Obama visited India, Dr. Akkai got up and talked to him at a town hall meeting in New Delhi.
The question is, when the state terror is against minorities, be it a transgender, be it a sexual minority, be it a class, caste, religious, race minority, when you have been stigmatized, you have been discriminated because nowhere of your reason, and the patriarchal notion and the power is dominating against you, and I want to take my strong objection on it. Right? Like the reason, like how do you speak? I'm a criminal before the Section 377, which criminalizes because you are a transgender, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and how do I raise my voice against this?
She talks about the Trans Protection Bill and how it was more what the government wanted and not what the trans community wanted.
I think across the world, we as sexual minorities, as transgender, facing social rejection, negligent way attitude. We are seeking for love, affection, acceptance. That is my question to you. How do I deal with that? My request.
The president's response was, use your voice, rally together. Akkai and her peers had already been doing that. Her petition against 377 was now pending in the Supreme Court, as were a host of other petitions. There was now a multi-pronged effort to get rid of the law. And luckily for these anti-377 crusaders, there would be yet another Supreme Court ruling that would essentially deliver the death knell to caution. That's on our next episode.
My request, can I hug you? That's
it. Well, we can have a hug after the event's over. Because otherwise we'll be doing a lot of hugging and I won't be answering any questions. But I can't speak to the specifics of legislation in India because I'm not qualified. And I think the answer is it begins with what you just did, to find your voice and to be able to articulate your views and your experiences and tell your story so that people start recognizing their own experiences in you. They see your humanity. Once that voice is there, hopefully others join you, right? And so now you have networks and organizations and allies. And then once that happens, it's a matter of applying political pressure and being able to mobilize public opinion.
audio footage of poet Akhil Khatyal is from a YouTube video uploaded by filmmaker Uma Thanaku. Thanks to Dr. Tarunab Khaitan for walking me through some of the legal principles that we discuss in this episode. 377 is a production of ATS Studio, a division of All Things Small. This episode was hosted by me, Sindhuri Nandakumar, and written by me and Ashim De Silva, who also produced the show. Script supervision is by Deveya Bopanna and Archana Nathan, with editorial input from Sidin Varukut and Supriya Nair. The music and sound design is by Madhav Ayachit, and the episode is mixed and mastered by Ankit Suryakant. Our executive producer is Gaurav Vaz. Our legal consultant is Amshula Prakash. We received administrative support from Anushka Mukherjee. All clips and voices used in this podcast are owned by their original creators. You can find more information about this episode and our show notes at allthingssmall.in/377.